Clear for takeoff, runway 28 left, fly runway heading.
Welcome to another brand new episode of Living in Flight, your go-to podcast for everything in the world of aviation. Exclusive interview conversations with industry professionals and enthusiasts. Strap on your seatbelt.
Put on your headset.
And get ready for Living in Flight.
Hi, everyone. Well, he just did it for me right there, right then and there. Pilot Daddy, also known Jet Clipper, maybe Clipper Aurora to some. But the name we'll go with today is Rob Busby. How y'all doing?
Where are you at right now?
I'm home right now, Charlotte, North Carolina. And it's a nice day. Right. Nice day down here. 75 degrees, partly cloudy skies with a very light breeze.
Oh, God. We got some snow up here, some freezing rain this morning. Up in Minneapolis, and I don't know, it's starting to warm up now, a brisk like 35 degrees.
Well, I mean, this is a pilot podcast, right? Should I say it like a pilot way? Well, the wind's out of the north northeast at 7 knots, ladies and gentlemen, and we got broken cloud layers, and the temperature's at 4 degrees Fahrenheit.
Might as well give them the altimeter setting while you're at it.
You got to make sure to also tell them about your expansive background, how you were a Navy pilot, how they should feel safe flying with you.
Because of hours that I have, yes.
And how you have a co-captain, not a
first officer. And my boat, too. Let me just throw in my boat and my airplane and my four other wives I have as well.
All right. Cool. Where are you from? Are you from North Carolina?
No. So born in Houston. You know, daddy lost his job down in Houston. So ended up moving up to Massachusetts. And I grew up in Massachusetts most of my time there. And then got hired at, you know, PSA Airlines, and then moved over Ohio for a little bit and then went to their base down in Charlotte. Been there ever since. So really the last 10, 15 years, Charlotte. Before that, just grew up in Massachusetts.
Mm-hmm. Nice. Did you always know you wanted to get into aviation, or how'd you get?
Yeah. So, you know, the story kind of sounds pretty boring. It's always usually the same thing you hear. You know what I mean? It's like, oh, I've always wanted to do this since the age of insert number 5, 6, or 7. You know what I mean? So, and sure enough, it was the same deal. So daddy lost his job down there in Texas. You know, they threw us on an airplane. It was a Continental jet, flew up to Massachusetts. That captain came and got me for some reason. Said, hey, you want to see the cockpit, boy, with his cigar in his mouth. And that was it. I was like, mommy, I want to be an airline pilot. And there it is, man. That ever since, there was nothing else.
Did he hand you like a little model of the airplane?
Back in the days, they actually did stuff like that. You know what I mean? Oh, here, son, here's a quart of jet fuel. Oh, thanks. Appreciate it. Yeah.
Okay. Awesome. So you wanted to be a pilot from a young age. When did you start your training?
Training didn't start until I actually went to school for it. So, you know, I'm down there. I grew up in a podunk town in Massachusetts, Southbridge. You know, not knocking it, but it was a great town. But anyway, Southbridge, Massachusetts, just outside of Worcester. If you're not from the area, people pronounce it Worcester. But yeah, so I wanted to be an airline pilot, obviously. So I'm going through the ranks there. And I said, well, what I got to do? Because none of my family ever flown. Nobody I knew flies. Nothing. The only experience I got was driving down to Boston Logan or driving down to Hartford and watching airplanes and just looking at pilots, and they looking at me like I'm crazy because I'm just staring at them in awe. You know what I mean? So I had nobody to kind of guide me. So I always went to my guidance counselor and said, hey, I want to be an airline pilot. What do I got to do? Well, it's either the military or the school called Embry-Riddle. And I said, what's faster to get to the airlines? And he said, Embry-Riddle. And I said, all right, I'll go to this Humpty Diddle school. Fine then, you know, then $117,000 in school loan debt because I come from absolutely nothing to pay for it. And then that rest is history. So I did all my training down in Daytona Beach. My very, very first flight ever was in a Riddle Cessna 172 going up in the air. So.
How'd you like the training?
I thought the training was really, really good. You know, I thought the training was fantastic. I mean, you're down there and it's like, all right, you get lost, you go east. You get lost, you go west, and you're going to run into an ocean. You know what I mean? So that's like, that sets the comfort zone. You mean, all our cross countries were north, south, east, west. You know, it was just like, it was almost like a crutch. You know what I mean? So you're able to get the airplanes in the, you're able to get the airplanes in the air and go do your training. And all their airplanes are pretty much, it was always new. You know, they had like a lease deal at the time with Cessna. So every 4 years, they got a brand spanking new airplane. And their motto was, hey, anything you see whatsoever, you write that sucker up and we'll down it. So you're always finding an airplane, a good airplane. And so the training I found anyway, and I haven't got any complaints or any bad failures from all my airline partners and myself and everybody I fly with seem to think I do a good job. So I'm going to say the training went pretty well.
Don't mean to don't mean to age you, but what year were you?
Dude, here we go. You have the age. You must have saw the gray. For those of you just joining us on the soundbite, I do have gray hair. Yep. That's why, hence the daddy on the pilot daddy. No. So I went to school in 98 and then graduated in 02.
Oh, dude, that's a wonderful time to get into aviation.
Yeah, it was really, really fantastic time getting into aviation. My gosh. And yeah, my very, very first flight instructor. So I got hired by the school as well to be a CFI. So here I am teaching kids, you know, ready to fly. And I'm all excited. It's September 11th, 2001. Getting that Cessna. It was a beautiful morning. Crystal clear, like the stories that you hear. You know what I mean? It was crystal clear. Sunrise as smooth as the air was smooth as silk. We get up in the air. And next thing you know, air traffic control is like, all right, Riddle 412, we're going to need you on the ground right now. Excuse me? Excuse, but what? Say that one more time. All airplanes in the United States are grounded. You need to return right now. So, of course, I have no idea what's going on. I have a brand new private pilot. He's shaking because it's his first time in the airplane. He looks at me. I'm shaking. I'm white because it's my first time teaching in an airplane. So here we are now. We're like, are we about to get nuked? I mean, I'm waiting for the freaking missile to come in or something like that. So, yeah, then we landed. And as soon as we walked in, the towers were already down and everything. So it was absolutely horrible. But, yeah, it was a tough, tough time, man.
I don't think I've ever heard of worse timing than having your first lesson be on. So when you, even then though, like prior to 9/11, what was the pilot hiring and career outlook like?
It wasn't that great. It was already, the airlines were already kind of in a stale point. Some airlines were in bankruptcy or like chapter, I don't know, so many damn chapters, but when they're allowed to operate still, you know, it's maybe about chapter 11, seven is they close up shop, right? So I know TWA just hit bankruptcy. And I think United was having a hard time, just barely staying alive there. So TWA was in bankruptcy and then American Airlines like, yeah, we're going to buy you. And then, so the airline world, and then around that time too, the regionals exploded, you know, right back in the region, you know, back what a regional should be, in my opinion. Way back when was what they were. You know, you flew a propeller from BFE to Charlotte, and it's a 30-minute flight. Well, that's a regional flight, you know what I mean? But at the time, Delta, United, US Air, American, all the other air, Northwest, they exploded in those CRJ-200s, you know, those hatchbacks. They exploded in that growth, and that's what it was. But then that was it. You know what I mean? That was it. It was like, all right, those you almost had to, like, be an astronaut just to be hired by that regional. It was horrible. Horrible trying to get into the airline world.
Yeah, and it's kind of interesting. Like, you talk about regionals, and it's like, you know, United will fly a 200 from Palm Springs to Denver. Like, that's a main line. That's amazing.
Oh, absolutely. When I flew PSA, it was a wholly owned regional for U.S. Airways. You know, at the time, U.S. Airways was the most, and it was dirt bottom of all the legacies. You know what I mean? It was like, all right, pretty much the cockroach. They just couldn't get rid of it fast enough. You know what I mean? So here we are. We were a wholly owned regional of the worst legacy carrier. And U.S. Airways was great. Don't get me wrong. Great people and everything like that. I'm not dogging them. It was just, you know, when it comes to rankings, they were the worst. And we were wholly owned by them. So whatever they did, we were the ones flying for them. That was it, period. And we didn't get to spread our love to United, Continental America, and all that stuff. So here we were. Delta's flying a 757 from Atlanta to Philadelphia, and U.S. Airways product was our CRJ-200 from Atlanta to Philadelphia. So they took off. We're just flying it behind them with our 50-seater regional jet while they're flying a 7576 all the way to freaking Philadelphia.
Well, so, now you got 737 flying EAS routes out of Minneapolis.
Yeah, we're finally starting to get too legit to quit. You know, United's starting to park all our RJs now. We're finally starting to get some fancy stuff now. So yeah, bring on the 1960s 737, baby.
Yeah, hey, at least they're NGs.
Oh, shoot, man. We got Maxes too, man. You gotta keep hip with the times. We got Maxes, baby.
Yeah. That's right. Oh, yeah, I forgot. There's another decade after another generation.
Jeez, and now we got the Maxes on board too. But yeah, it's a good product. It's a great airplane. I mean, the sucker never breaks. You know, it's bulletproof almost. You know, so it's a good ride.
So 2002 comes around. I mean, I was going to jump there. You good with that, Drew?
Yeah, that's where I was going to go.
What happens in 2002? Right, you graduate. The market is
So I ended up doing an internship with Continental Airlines, you know, so so the airlines kind of like sputtered around and like, all right, we're going to start internships again after September 11th, after all the investigations, all that stuff went through. Did an internship with Continental. While I was at Continental, you know, they gave me their MD-80 training, which I got some credit for school. So here I am. I'm like, all right, I have 250 hours. I got, you know, 30 hours multi wet, you know, I'm all wet behind the ears. I'm like, I need to get out there and try to find my way into getting these regionals. So I'm contacting Continental Express, which at that time they're owned by Continental, which was Bar Harbor, which was turned into ExpressJet, which turned into, well, nothing now. And then you have ASA. Oh, this is the best story in the world. ASA, which was, you know, they operated, they were wholly owned for Delta. Then Delta, you know, canned them. They merged with ExpressJet. Now they're gone. Bye-bye. See you later. So I remember calling them in the office that I was at 1600 Smith in the skyscraper in Houston, a Continental headquarters, like, hey, check me out. I heard Embry-Riddle was the creme de la creme. I got my Embry-Riddle stamp. I got my internship. I got my 250 hours. What can we do for me? So I had it. I actually had a phone. I actually had the phone number to ASA Human Resources. And I'll never freaking forget it because it pissed me off. I call like, hey, yeah, it's me. How you doing? Oh, yeah, good, good. Okay, so what kind of experience you had? And I told them the experience. They said, yeah. So to be able to fly for ASA, fly a CRJ-200, you know, the Mac Daddy 200, we encourage you to go get some jet turbo prop time first and then contact us. I'm like, you sons of guns, right? So they had the audacity. They wanted me to go freaking pay like Gulfstream, which is now Silver. They had those Beach 1900s, right? Or go pay somebody to get this freaking turbo prop time. Then I can go and apply for a CRJ 200 slot. Yeah, man, that hit hard. That was like, whoa, we're in tough shape here. So back off to Riddle I go, and I instructed there for another 2 years. You know what I mean? Man, I did not like instruction, but you do what you got to do.
Yeah,
that's really a sign of the times, because like you're sitting there dreaming of getting to fly the ASA CRJs, when for like Matt and I, it was devastating when we had to fly one of the old ASA CRJs because SkyWest.
Absolutely,
was using
absolutely, man.
I would bid a void the CRJ 200. I would just, you know, the 900 is a, and the routes and stuff that we did out of Minneapolis, whatever, the whole works, but I would bid a void the 200, like the plague, and it worked for most of the time. So you get reflowed and put on one and you can't avoid it at that point.
Now, PSA, we had five CRJ 700s. So we had, you know, 4200s and we had five 700s. So if you flew that 700, you were a Mac Daddy. You walked in the airport with your sunshades on at midnight. You felt too cool for school. This bad boy's got two labs, baby. Yeah. So yeah. And then you had to go back to that hatchback 200, and yeah, it would even flying. It was like, oh man. But like you said, trying to fight to get on with. You thought you were something else until you're there and like, oh yeah, I'm a still.
Kind of sounds like a. Kind of sounds like the ERJ fleet that's got.
Oh man, no, I believe. Oh, Sherry.
It's a whole different. When I was there, it was like wildly different of like the CRJ flying versus the ERJ flying, and the egos behind both of them. Drew likes to.
I hear SkyWest, the guys were like, if they flew the ERJs, right? If they flew the ERJs, they would call themselves Mainline SkyWest, and then the CRJs was the Express operation, right? Yeah, I got
Mainline Light.
Yeah,
it's Mainline Light. You look at those West Coast schedules, and it's like they've never been to a place where people in wheelchairs have to be put in like a makeshift elevator to get on and off the plane.
Yeah, yeah. So you have the outside guy with WD-40 trying to freaking loosen it up so the little makeshift elevator goes up. Oh yeah, yep.
It's all in good fun, but it was funny how wildly different it was. But hey, all right. We picked what we did.
I tell you what, though, the best thing in that CRJ, hands down, and anybody can argue with me, I mean, the number one best thing in the world, you're up in the air, you just ate this huge pasta bowl with sausage, cheese, peppers, everything, and your stomach's just going nuts. And as soon as you finally park, you don't need to wait for a jet bridge driver. You don't need to wait for the flight attendants to get things on. You don't need to wait for them to disarm. You get down, you hurry up and grab that damn handle. And you shove that damn door down, man. You jump down those stairs. You're in a bathroom within 5-10 minutes. You're good to go. That's the only thing I loved about that CRJ.
the first.
Yeah, yeah. You really find the best little diamond in the rough sometime. You know what I mean?
Oh. That's right. That's right.
So, you went back to it. Like, okay, it's now to kill the good times and go back to the times when you really couldn't find.
Bring him back to the dumps, aren't you? Fuck.
Yeah, back in the dumps. So back to the dumps. So you went back to instructing. How long did you instruct? So how long did you instruct for again? And what was kind of the next big break for you?
Yeah, so September 11th, 2001 was the first day of instruction. And then I got hired by PSA in April of 2004, I think. I'll say either April or June, somewhere on those lines. But it was a good solid 3 solid years of instruction, you know. And at first, you know, here you are. You're no longer the student. You are now the big CFI. And at Riddle, they pretty you up. You know, they make you look like an airline pilot. And then you're in your pilot gear. You got your stripes on. You got your little pen. You feel so cool. And then you walk out. You see the Continental Express ERJ taxi, the 145 taxiing by. You just stop and stare. Wow, that sweet. You know. Then you see Delta MD-80 taxi by. Like, wow, sweet. And you're dressed just like them. So they walk to their MD-80, and then here I am. I walk to my freaking my Cessna C-172. You know what I mean? That's like night.
Hey, at least there was
weather, and here you are already sweating profusely. They're like, no, keep that tie nice and tight, boy. Oh yeah. So instruction. So it's 3 solid years of instruction in Embry-Riddle, and I did the CFI, the MEI, the CFII. I did it all. You know, the spin trainings and all that stuff. It's like, I tell you what, one day in the middle of summertime, and you had to be qualified for everything, right? Over there, you had to be qualified. They're like, hey, we need you to do, we need you to do some CFI spin training for us, but we need to qual you. So they put you up with their Czech airmen, and they say, all right, here's a spin. Recovered. Okay, I recovered. Okay, you're signed off. So here we are. So a whole day of freaking. So then they give you all the students. Like, all right, here's our spin airplane. Go up there with these 8 students and just spin the sugar out of them. Sure enough, man, 8. I never felt sick in my life. So you go up to 3,000 feet above the shoreline. You spin them down, or 8,000 feet above the shoreline. You spin them down one by one by one by one all day long. That was the one and only time I've ever gotten sick in an airplane. Didn't vomit by any means, but you felt it. You know what I mean? So that was just my joyous period of flight instruction. And then towards the end, you know, and here you are, you have a student and you're here, you're ready to sign off a student, right? For their big first solo. Here they are excited. They just freaking, you know, they just loaded up their pants. You know, they're all excited. They're ready to go, a little scared. Here you are, you're signing their logbook. You're writing really slow to make sure you got the right nice penmanship. You feel cool and good about yourself, right? Look, mom, I finally made it, right? Towards the end of the CFI gig for me was it was New Smyrna, right? I'm flying with this guy, and I'm like, yeah, I think he'll live. So here we are. So I open the door, we park, I open the door, I get out, and I'm signing his logbook on the chair. You know what I mean? This is right before I got hired. I signed his logbook on the chair, and I look up at him in mid-drift, mid-pin, you know, and I'm looking up at him and said, hey. And he goes, what? And he's scared. He's got the deer in the headlights look. He's kind of sweating a little bit. And I said, whatever you do, if you crash, make sure my name, my signature burns real good, because I don't want to have my evidence on it. You know what I mean? And he just gave me this freaking, he just gave me that look of fear. And then I shut the door, locked it, and said, see you later. Have a good time.
I used to tell my students as I got out of the plane, I don't trust you enough to leave my wallet in this plane, but I trust you enough to leave my headset. And that usually got him a good little chuckle. But I still remember, like, the best day was when I think I left being a flight instructor and all my, like, that last solo endorsement finally expired. Fantastic day.
Just a weight's been lifted off your shoulder. You know what I mean? And here I am during this time of the 3 years. I mean, it was a whole different world, gentlemen. And of course, I just sound old when I say that, but it was a whole different ball game. And here I was flying to Houston. I was flying to all these regional operators. I was flying to ACA, which turned into Independence Air, which turned into nothing. You know what I mean? I was flying to Dulles. I was flying to all these airline, yeah, PSA up in Dayton, Ohio, or up to you guys in Mini. What was it? Was it Airline? Who were they? Northwest Airlines? Was it Pinnacle or
Pinnacle?
Yeah, or Skyway up in Milwaukee. And I'm flying to these headquarters, just sitting outside waiting for somebody to open the door so I can sneak in. Literally open the door so you can sneak in and try to get your name in there. Here's my resume. Well, who are you? What are you applying for, a janitor's position? No, pilot. It pays less. You know what I mean? So it's like, all right, tooth and nail, tooth and nail. It's like, it's just, I almost gave up. Really, I almost gave up. I'm like, you know what? Screw this. Circuit City. I worked for Circuit City during all this time too. And Circuit City, like, hey, we'll make you a manager of the Daytona Beach store. You'll end up getting. We'll get you a district manager. Well, thank God I didn't take that Circuit City gig. You see where they're at as well. They shut down back in 09. But so finally, a buddy of mine calls me. I say, Rob, PSA Airlines. Ever heard of them? Like, I don't even know how to spell PSA, so I have no idea what you're talking about. Like, yeah. The airline called PSA Airlines. They fly Dornier props. They're getting 150 regional jets from US Airways. They're hiring. They're about to open the door, hiring like gangbusters. Make it. They want to see you. They want to meet you. I'm like, meet me. I'm like, I don't even have the 300 multi-engine time that they want. It's like, well, I told them you had 250. So I told them you have 250. Just meet them. They're willing to interview. Just send them the resume right now. So that day, it was Wednesday. Wednesday, I sent them the resume. They said, hey, we want to interview. It was Thursday, but they want you to drive down to Fort Lauderdale. I'm like, sure, I'll drive down to Fort. Are you kidding me? Get an airline interview job? I'll drive anywhere. So I'll fly. He wants you to drive down 95 down to Fort Lauderdale. And on Thursday, which was the very next day. Of course, I canceled all my flight lessons. I told my boss, yeah, I ain't flying the rest of the weekend. How you doing? And then on my drive down there, you know, I'm in my suit and tie, ready. Because I did it Thursday morning, you know. So I did Thursday morning because I got the information late. Did it Thursday morning. I'm in my suit and tie. I'm sweating profusely. Next thing, I'm on the highway, man. Pow! The damn freaking tire blows up on me. I'm like, you know, maybe this airline gig isn't right for me. Somebody's telling me something. I mean, it was just such a struggle just to get that CRJ 200 first officer position. I got down there. They're like, wow, we're quite impressed how you just came down here in the blink of an eye. I'm like, you know how hard it is to get down here? And they all know, you know, they knew what the gig was. And so they actually hired me right on the spot. Was like, man, I was on cloud nine. It was the best feeling in the world. It was a better feeling then than when I got hired by United. It was like, it was just such a great, it was like, oh my God, thank you. I'm so done. I can't wait for this pay cut from the Cessna to the CRJ. It's going to be fantastic. You know? So sure, we're going to hire you on the spot. And when can you start? Like, when do you want me? They said, how about Monday? And of course, you know, the rule of thumb is always give your employer, you know, 2 weeks, 2 week notice. So 2 week notice, I'm like, shit, I ain't giving nobody any notice. But I tell you what, right now, I'm going to call them up on them. So my drive home with my little itty bitty spare tire going about 50, 60, 90 miles an hour, I think barely falling off my Mercury Sable, baby. Yeah. Daddy drove the Mercury Sable back in college days. Yeah, so I thought, man, I'm calling up the school. I'm like, hey, they're like, what's up, man? You got ready for your next lesson? I'm like, yeah, next lesson, my ass. I said, I quit. All done. I'm not doing anymore. And I'm leaving town tomorrow. Man, I packed up my house that night. The very next day, I was driving back up to Massachusetts, threw all my junk in my parents' house, and then I drove over to Ohio, baby. And there I was, Dayton, Ohio, America's number one vacation hotspot, corporate headquarters of PSA Airlines. Man, I was a CRJ 200 pilot making $14,000 a year.
It doesn't get any better.
It doesn't.
Than that.
If I could rewind time, baby, woo, I'd do it all over again. Yeah.
So yep. Funny.
So, what was life like? Because we've had a pretty, like, you know, pretty gilded experience, you know, for Matt and I in the financial situation at the regionals, right? Like, 90 an hour. You know, that was you were getting 300%, man. Like, we were making, you're making.
I haven't touched a 90 an hour yet. Just letting you know, I wasn't there when they did that.
Oh, you're right. You weren't there. Bummer.
I was at 46 an hour, which is
46 an hour, and I was there,
rich, man,
for a little bit at 90.
Hilton. Yeah.
So, what was that life like for you? You know, living off of 14,000 flying an RJ.
It was horrible. It was absolutely horrible. I mean, here you are, you're dressed to the nines, you're flying this big jet, and you're flying this $30 million jet, and you're feeling all cool about yourself. But on the other hand, you're basically living in a crash pad. You know, when I got there, like, yeah, we have these things called crash pads because you can't afford an apartment or anything like that. I'm like, crash pad? They're like, yeah, I've got a crash pad over here in Dayton, Ohio. And if you can imagine a crash pad in Dayton, Ohio versus maybe like a crash pad, maybe like LA, maybe like, you know, some good looking people. No, I'm just saying. So the crash pad was loaded full of PSA flight attendants. It was just one pilot that ran it. But for some reason, he called me up. He's like, hey, man, you want to go to my crash pad? I'm like, I don't know. The idea of sleeping with other men in the same room kind of weirds me out. No, they're all flight attendants. I'm like, oh, I'll entertain it. Sure, why not? Yeah, here I am. I'm a 24-year-old kid. I'm single, you know, young, ready to mingle, right? So I'm like, all right, let me get some of that. So The rent was 200, the price was $250, right? So let's do the math, right? $250. I'm still paying maybe like $300 a month for my sweet Mercury Sable, you know, and all you got your insurance, you got this and you got that. Also, guess who wanted their money too? That $117,000 in student loan debt that I postponed, forbeared, because I couldn't afford to do that on Embry-Riddle money, right? So now, my first paycheck at PSA, which is where we're paid biweekly, my first paycheck was $400. Stellar. And my second paycheck, now the second paycheck's the big one, right? It's got all your per diem, it's got your extra overs, it's got everything. Like, man, second paycheck, here's the pilot life. Boom! $600, baby. Total $1,000. Well, my student loan payment was $1,200 a month. So go ahead and do that math. So needless to say, you meet one of those gorgeous flight attendants, or you meet somebody that you're like, hey, baby, yeah, you want to go do something? I don't know. I got the per diem from the hotel, but oh my gosh, no. Financial wise, it was absolutely horrible. And it's just like, there's nothing you could do. So literally, I was 24 years old, just graduated college, $117,000 in debt. I'm driving this amazing brand spanking new CRJ jet engine turbine, and I'm living in mommy and daddy's basement. That was the life, baby. That was it. And yeah, and then of course, US Airways hits bankruptcy. So PSA's bankruptcy, right? So we weren't staying at the glorious Hampton Inns that you guys might have stayed at, or the glorious La Quintas, which was Spanish for crapshoot, right? No. We were staying in microtels. We were staying in the Hojos. We were staying in the Super 8s, Red Roofs Inn. Oh, yeah. And if there wasn't a strip club or a bowling alley or a Waffle House nearby, then it wasn't a hotel for PSA at that time. You know what I mean? It was disgusting. And I shoot you not. I mean, and that we wouldn't pay those bills either. So here we are. We were getting escorted out of the hotel because PSA/US Airways wasn't paying their bill because they were in bankruptcy. Woo, man. The airline life, baby. I mean, mom, I made it. It was, the fun never stops. I mean, it was just.
Wait, did you actually get escorted out of a hotel?
Escorted. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. 3 a.m. in the morning. Oh, yeah. They're like, hey. They're beating on the doors of all the PSA crews, which there was only about two crews there. You know what I mean? They're beating on the doors. Out you go. You're not paying. PSA owes us like $10,000 or something like that. You know what I mean? So they, oh yeah, we were escorted out and everything. Yep. Here we were outside our luggage or the cold. We're calling scheduling. And they weren't answering the phone. So yeah, they throw it on your credit card. Or we actually, a lot of us went back to the freaking airport and just waited by the dang terminal to open up because it's these small airports. They weren't open 24 hours. So we're just sitting there like, homeless bums, which we were. We were just homeless bums flying that RJ. It was great.
What were your rest and duty rules like in that time?
Man, it was before 117 came out, so I don't remember. All I know is my body could take it. You know what I mean? I was like I said, I was 24. I was what, 24 to 27 before 117 came out. You know, I mean, you do a flight. You would be 11 o'clock midnight, or you'd have a flight at 10. They call them stand ups, or you know, you do a 10 o'clock flight. You go fly somewhere. You spend 3 hours in a hotel, then you do the flight back in the morning. You know, there were things like that. I mean, and with our schedules, because we were a true regional we were just flying those prop routes with our CRJ 200. So we were doing 8 damn legs a day. You know, we're doing Charlotte, Jacksonville, North Carolina, Charlotte, Fayetteville, North Carolina, Charlotte, Greenville, Spartanburg, South Carolina, Charlotte. And then you'd overnight at an amazing place called freaking Pitt, Greenville, North Carolina, where Pepsi was. Oh, that was nice. Real nice. And we get booted out of that hotel. I think it was a Wingate that we got booted out of that one. That was nice. But yeah, we were doing, you know, those 8 legs a days, and here we are. It was in a 10 over, you know, it'd be a short overnight. That's what killed us the most. It was those, the length of overnight stays that we had, and the hotels were junk. And we'd have 10 hour overnights or 9 hour overnights. We had 8 hours solid. Those rules didn't apply either. So yeah, you're scheduled for 8, but who cares? You know, we can hold you to whatever, you know. Oh, your plane was late, so what? You know, be here at the airport at 5 in the morning, ready to rock. And there we were. But the only good thing about that regional was, like, we were all in it together. You know, we were all homeless bums. We were all poor, broke as a joke. We were all just like, oh my God, I can't believe this is life. But when we get in the air, it's nothing like that engine, you know, that it's nothing like that engine noise, nothing like the wind noise against the fuselage. It's nothing like that boom, the sound you get in there. There's just nothing like that. And then when you land, all the problems go ahead and come right back into your head. You know what I mean? Yeah.
Yeah.
That was the fun part, like at the regionals, the we're all in this together experience, even though it wasn't as, you know, bad as yours. there were times where it was like, all right, like we're going to get through this, the four of us, because, you know, you keep the same flight attendants with you the whole trip. You guys all stay together. There was a fun camaraderie to it. So when did you upgrade?
So it was a short upgrade, thank God. It was it was a 3.5 year upgrade, and of course.
Three and a half years.
That was like, wow, unheard of. This is like crazy fast. 3.5 year upgrade, and of course you don't. Unlike the majors, you know, like, ah, do I really want to upgrade? I don't know. But then you're like, you want to upgade because guess what? You're waiting for those majors to get that PIC jet turbine time. So yeah, upgrade in 3.5 years, and that was in 2007. Yeah, 2007, and yeah, that's when I traded in that sweet Mercury Sable. Yeah, baby, traded in that Mercury Sable for a GMC Sierra. That was my big upgrade present. Like, yeah, I'm finally going positive with the money flow. So let's go ahead and get in more debt. Let me just go ahead and drive the captain truck, right? I still have that truck to this day. Yep.
What was the pay change?
It was definitely night and day, and I forgot what the FO wages were, but I know the captain wage was like, I think high 70s was the rate there. And I immediately became a check airman too. So that gave you another 25% on top of that. And we were starting to hire like crazy until 2008 happened. So I was able to get that override. So finally money was starting to come in a little bit. I think I finally broke like $100,000 maybe on my eighth year at PSA or ninth year at PSA. I finally broke that big six figures. It's like, woo, man. Yeah. Student loans were not buying it though. They were still wanting more of that money.
Yeah, they always do.
So what was it like being a line check airman back prior to the 1500 hour rule?
Pretty cool. So again, like every step that you go, and you guys know this, right? Yeah. So you go from your the Cessna or whatever the hell, you go to your regional, you feel cool as school until it gets old, or you feel cool as school until you're like, wow, this really isn't too cool. You're a CRJ 200 first officer. You really don't rank anywhere. You know, you're junk. You're bottom of the barrel. Then you become the big captain, the four banger, right? Big four stripe, and like, ooh, maybe somebody calls you captain in the terminal, and you hold your head up high, like, ooh, yeah, say it again, please. You know what I mean? But then you think about it again, like, wait. I'm a CRJ 200 captain. Nope, you're still bottom of the barrel. You know what I mean? You're not that cool. You know what I mean? You're still nobody as you taxi out and you're trying to match the nose wheel because the nose wheel does this on the taxi out. So you're trying to match it with your freaking, the tiller, right? Tiller, what you steer the thing with. So you're trying to match it, try to keep that dang CRJ 200 to taxi straight forward. Cause I was always a fast taxier. So the rudders weren't there for me. What the hell were we talking about? Hit me up again. What were we talking about? So then you upgrade a captain, right? And you're feeling all cool about yourself. And then that starts kind of getting like, all right, please. And you see the Airbuses, the 73s, see all the mainline jets, you know, they're taxiing by, but they're all under bankruptcy contracts. So really you're actually making more, which we did. We actually made more in that CRJ 200 captain than what the 737 US Airways captains and first officers were making. That's how ridiculously weird that industry was back then. The 737 captains and FOs were making less than what the captains at the PSA CRJ 200 were making, which that made you feel good, but then it made you feel sad. You're like, oh God, this is just not what I dreamt this would be. So finally, it's like, all right, so now it's check airman time. And now you're like, oh yeah, here I am now. I got the check airman, I got that stamp. Now I can go ahead and give that out to the majors. And now you're like, you finally feel like you're somebody, you know, like, oh wow, here I am, big check airman. You know, they see your name, you walk up to the flight deck and you sound like, hey boys, yeah, what we're going to do here is we're going to do a little line check. All right. And you kind of do that. You move your chin around ever so slowly. You sit down, you sit there, you watch them. Right. Then of course you have to do that signature line. You've been waiting to say that signature line too. Like, well, real nice flight. So let me just go ahead and just a couple things. You got your pen, you made a couple stupid notes. You just make up something like, well, if you just would have, kicked that rudder in a little early, I think you might have been pretty good. Anything for me? No. Okay. Good. See you later. And then you go sign the guys off. See, it really felt so cool. But again, you're a check airman on a CRJ 200. You really ain't anything really, you know what I mean? You're really in the whole spectrum of things. You're really nothing. But it was the cool thing was like you were taking these guys from a Cessna, and now they're in a CRJ jet. And I tell you what, teaching CFI training while I was a CFI, just teaching kids how to fly, teaching people older than I how to fly on the Cessna. Yeah, that was a challenge, and that was good and it was rewarding. But then on that CRJ, it was more challenging taking a guy from the Cessna to. I mean, and before 2008, it was a 250-hour wonder because we were hiring 250-hour guys with their wet multi-engine stamp there. And then, boom, you're throwing them right in a jet. I'm like, all right, let's see a downwind base final, baby. And they're doing 250 when they're used to freaking doing 60. You know what I mean? So that was the challenge. You know, that was like, oh, boy, here we go. And then you're getting yelled at by all the other airlines. Move, CRJ, move, as you're on the taxiway trying to teach. You know what I mean? So then, of course, so you're doing that, and then, you know, and 2008 happens, and you're starting to get up 1,500-hour wonders. And when I say wonders, too, they were wonders. Oh, my word. But then the really, really cool part was teaching, you're sitting there as an FO, and you're teaching captains. You're teaching brand spanking new captains, and that was my absolute favorite, teaching the new captains. And it's like, I'm not teaching them how to fly. I'm not teaching them how to freaking handle themselves, that type of thing. But what I am teaching them is... I don't want to hear any mother loving us in your pilot announcement. And I'd have a piece of paper. And I'm like, all right, man, let's hear this pilot announcement to your passengers. Folks. Nope. I don't want to hear folks either. Okay. Folks was like 1960s term. All right. We're no longer folks. You know, we're people, you know,
folks.
And I jot it down.
We're from the flight deck.
And I'd show them. And usually the average was about like 22 us. 22 mother loving us that they do in that pilot announcement. Like, damn, you sound like a freaking moron. I don't want to fly with you. And I'd be ripping them to shreds in that cockpit. I'm like, you sound like an idiot. You fly airplanes? Come on. I mean, you should go to work at a freaking mental asylum or something like that. Because guess what? This CRJ thing ain't happening for you. And I'm just rattling up, right? I'm just throwing all this stuff that just makes me go. And of course, it's the guys that do say the and the girls that do say the us, as soon as you get in the air, they're going to say another group of words. I'm sure you can probably guess them too. As soon as they check in with air traffic control, Blue Streak, with you. And of course, I'm writing that down too. With you? No, shoot, we're with them. You just checked in. You're with them. Yeah, with you. Did you learn that in Cessna school? See, man, even my veins starting to pop here, right? Because even the mainline. That because you're so stuck in your ways. I'm like, so when I was down there teaching these people how to do that, I was like, no more. Let's just stop the stereotype. No more us, no more with yous, no more and like we're continuing a sentence. You know, it's like if you ever listen on the things, it's this ever long continuation of sentence that whenever all the pilots are up there with air traffic control
and Continental 493 and Delta da, 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 and Skyway, you know.
And, what do you mean, and? Start the sentence. Capital letter. Let's go. Start the damn sentence. You know, so it's like, it would be stuff like that. I'm like, now's your chance to really really mentor your first officers to not sound like a freaking moron. You know what I mean? So that was the biggest thing with me. And then, of course, another thing that bothered me is like, listen here, pal, Frank, we'll call him Frank, right? Listen, Frank, as at the end, you know, where he's all signed off. He's ready to go. He's got his four bars on. He's ready to rock. He's already yelling at flight attendants. I said, you fly, you are a captain on a CRJ 200. You're a nobody. You're a nobody to me. You're a nobody to them. People don't even care. I mean, pastors see you. They're like, nah, pilots don't get what we got before. You are a CRJ 200 captain. You're a nobody. So keep yourself humble, okay? Don't like, folks, captain speaking. Here I am. Look at me roar. Treat people with respect. The golden rule, you know, treat your flight attendants like they're your equal because they are your equal. Treat your first officers like they're your equal because they are your equal. They're there to learn. And here you are yelling at them for some bullshit, for some bull reason. You know what I mean? It's like you're reaching over, you're holding the flags. You want flaps? You want flaps? You want flaps? Treat them with respect. And everything that irritated you about the captains that you hated, I hope you took mental notes because guess what? You're a big daddy now. Go ahead and do what you didn't want to do. And even such, some guys will still do it. But that was the most enjoyable time was teaching those new captains because you guys already know how to fly. You know, you're captains for crying out loud. You already knew how to fly. I was just there to freaking make you more like me, you know, make you more, a little bit, you know, tweak you a little bit like, yeah, you sound like an idiot. Or yeah, the way you just talk to your flight attendant, she wants to shoot you and smash you over the head. Yeah, the way you just talk to those passengers, they think you're a moron. You know, it's just stuff like that. So that was a rewarding thing. But then again, towards the end, I became the fix-it guy. I became the, because at that, it was 2015 when I got hired by the major. So 2015, we were scraping the bottom of that. Well, much like they're doing now, right? They're scraping the bottom of the barrel. They just to get anybody with a breath. And PSA, we just had the CRG 200, the couple of freaking 700s. We weren't anything. They're definitely not the PSA that it is today. So if you wanted to go fly, you wanted to go fly for SkyWest, Comair, you wanted to go fly for, you know, whatever the big ones are, that were, or Republic, you know, you wanted to go fly that fancy ERJ 170. Woo-hoo-hoo, daddy, please. But the, but nobody wanted to come to PSA. So they're really scraping that bottom. You know what I mean? So the people we were getting was like, oh my word. And whenever I was going through, maybe when you guys are going through, you know, you're allowed 6 sim sessions. Maybe you're allowed an additional one for XT, but if you didn't get it, see you later. Bye bye. But now, you know, you're like,
all right, we'll give you like 40 more XTs, you know, whatever we got to do. And then we'll throw you out to the check airman. Here I am, the check airman out there with a freaking smile on my face, waiting for these guys to come out there. I'm like, all right, let me look at your record.
You did how many sims? How many freaking sims? Oh my gosh. What? And you're looking at that and here you are. You're basically back in Cessna 172 school going for the first time and teaching these kids how to fly in a CRJ that shouldn't be there in the first place. And so it turned out to be that I would end up becoming the fix-it guy, meaning that you had your simulator guys and then got them through however they got them through. Then they toss them to the check airman out in the line for the IOE. And if that check airman couldn't do it, they still would give him 80 hours and still like, all right, well, go to this last guy. And I was one of the last guys. And it killed me because, you know, it's like, all right, if I can't get them to do it, they're done. You know, they're done. And I don't ever, ever, ever want to tell anybody you're done. You know what I mean? It's like, you're done. I mean, I don't want to ruin anybody's dreams. And that killed me the most, but it's just what I was becoming. And they're like, you are here because you can fix, you know, some of the stupidity. Like, for example, we had a guy out there, just got out of the sim, brand spanking new CRJ 900. Woo! We just got our first 900 there. They're flying along with a check airman, is on IOE. They plowed into a runway. Boom. $10 million in damage. You know, plowed into the runway, right? He was, so I get the phone call the night before. I'm like, all right, Rob, we got another one for him. I'm like, all right, let me hear what this freaking guy did. Like, yeah, you know that CRJ? I'm like, what? Wait, what? We didn't let him go? I heard about this guy. Why is he still here?
Oh, no, we're going to see if you can fix him. Like, oh, sweet mother of pearl. Right, really? Oh, my gosh. Please, no.
And just to give you guys a hint, I'll never forget this one, man. I had to take 7 out of his 10 landings. I mean, I tried to do everything in my human being power to get this guy to be able to land a CRJ. You know, it's like, all right, try to land it normal, you know, 50, 40, 30 K, walk out the power, touchdown with your mains, hold the nose up. Nope, that didn't work. I'm like, all right, how about you land it flat? Nope, that didn't work. All right, let's leave the power in there. Let's go ahead and glow, you know, just freaking, you know, stay in ground effect halfway down the runway and see if you can land that one. Nope, that didn't work either. There are so many different ways just to try to get him a picture. You know what I mean? He just wasn't meant to be a pilot. You know, it's not for all, you know, which we have to realize it's not for all. But this, I just couldn't do it. And I remember, God, I remember when I was just like this, I remember I took the controls last minute. So I was able to, It was this last split second. I tried to take it as far as he possibly could to see, yeah, if you continue, you're going to die. You know what I mean? So I let it go just that much further. And then finally I took the controls. And the only way to saving grace was actually shove the controls down just to kind of level it off, you know, level it onto that runway. And of course it smashes. We bounce. And it was like, we taxied again. It was Columbus and it was snowing. And he's shaking, you know, and I got no words. I'm sitting there. We pull up to the gate. He's starting to get up to put his vest. I'm like, I got to walk around, okay? I got to walk around. And it's snowing. I didn't put my jacket on. I didn't put my blazer on. I didn't put my hat on. I put nothing on. I walked out there, man. Here's the smokes coming from my mouth because of the freaking, it's so cold. It's snowing. I just go and I lean up against that nose wheel. I lean up against that nose of the empennage, not the empennage, the fuselage. And I just kind of rock myself. Like you were a baby that comforted you. You know what I mean? Like you kind of rock yourself to comfort yourself. You know what I mean? As the smoke's going, you can hear the snowflakes. Like, oh my God, please. Why is this me? 2 weeks later, I finally had a mainline interview and I was like, oh, thank you. And then out I went. Yep. So, oh yeah.
Yeah. You know, it's funny. It's like, cause at SkyWest, they were really quick. Like if you started taking up too much sim sessions, you were done. Like yeah. I think you had like 10 extra hours and they found a correlation between like every hour over 10 of like extra training you receive equates to like exponential more hours of IOE required to get you through once you get to the airplane. And so, yeah, it's tough to, that's gotta be tough to get to smashing planes. So when did you start applying to the majors? When did you, which one were you targeting? How'd you know where you wanted to go? Or
I was applying to majors as soon as I walked out of Cessna 172 Embry-Riddle in 04. Or was it 04? Yeah, as soon as I walked out of 04, my applications were in there. And now, I mean, just the online applications were starting to come about. So you just put your stuff in there and you just constantly update. And then add your new qualifications that you would get in there. You know what I mean? Never get, on occasion. And then you would go through your logbooks on occasion, make sure there's no errors. And you're just always constantly ready. But I was at PSA for 11 and a half glorious years. And that 11 and a half glorious years, my applications were everywhere, you know, absolutely everywhere, trying to get out, you know, trying to get to one of these majors to look at me. You know, here I was, I had 10, gosh, how many hours did I have? I had 11,000 hours. I had, you know, jet turbine, nothing on a record, clean record, check airman. You know, I interviewed, I hired, I did this, I did that. I had every single box checked. Well, it just wasn't good enough. This wasn't good enough. But yeah, my application was everywhere from the get-go.
Was United the first to call?
No, so Virgin America called. They called a few years before that. They flew us out to was it San Francisco at that point? Yeah, San Francisco at that point. It was some old US Airways furloughed guys that were out there and interviewed over there. Didn't get the job. Oh yeah, man, we can't wait to hire you. You're gonna be great. Oh man, can't wait. Got a letter in the mail about a week later, like, yeah, we regret to inform you. Yeah, we don't want to hire you. I'm like, oh, all right. Sounds good. Thanks. Yeah. You know, I love those guys. And then here we were back again, waiting. And PSA didn't have a flow at that point with US Airways. And then, US Airways called and here that, you know, went over to Phoenix for the interview, got hired. Sorry, we're just waiting a class date now. Just waiting the class date. All right. Sounds good. You know, live in Charlotte, ready to go. Here it is. US Airways. Finally, you know, we got hired. I'm all excited, all happy, go lucky. And then United chimed in. Which that was always the dream to go back to Continental because the internship there, and of course, I was born in Houston. But then United called up. They said, hey, I'm going to give us a shot. And I was like, oh, man, I just got hired by US Airways. Should I go try them out? Well, yeah, let's go try them out. And they flew me out to Denver. Rest is history, man. I was like, oh, yeah. And they had a 737 sim you had to go fly. That was part of the interview. They had to go fly a sim. You had to go do some HR. And guys, just to prep for the interview. You know, you don't want to take, even though it's easier to get hired now, it's like, you don't want to never take anything for granted. You know what I mean? It's like, oh, yeah, they'll hire me. They'll get me. You never take anything for granted. You always want to be, you know, 100%, 110% ready to rock. So I had an HR guy, you know, go through my stuff with me. And then I had an opportunity to go fly a sim for $2,500 for an hour to get myself ready. I'm like, I ain't spending $2,500 to fly a sim and then not get the job. No, thank you very much.
Big mistake. So straight out of hiring at United, which plane were you put on?
A 737.
Now, which variant were they flying at that point? Was it slew that they used to have? Or
yeah, no, they didn't have the 300s or the 500s anymore. They just parked the rest of the 500s. So it was just the 7-3, the 7-8, and 900s.
And so how long did you sit as an FO at United? What was that time like? Was there relief? Did you finally feel like you'd made it or?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. You tell you what, the dream, you know, the dream that we've all dreamt about, you know, or at least my dream anyway, the dream was there, you know, and when you walk in there, and anybody's listening to this, that's like a 15-year SkyWest wonder that has all the credentials that I might have, that I had, and then all the credentials that you have coming from your regional. You know, you were somebody at your regional, or you were somebody when you came into United. But guess what? As soon as you walk through that door, you are a nobody. You are bottom of the barrel. You are bottom of that list, and you better act accordingly, or you're gonna get yourself in trouble. You know what I mean? So here I am. I walk in. That's exactly what I did. I was no longer check airman. I was no longer captain. I was no longer this. I was no longer that. And I was happy. I was so ecstatic. I just couldn't hide it. You know what I mean? I was like, yeah, all I could do is walk around, just listen to this guy yell at me for a little bit. Sure, this is great. I'm finally in that 737. I got a hot meal in front of me, which is fantastic, right? We're flying just two legs a day. This is amazing. And then whenever somebody would come in and, oh my God, Captain, we have somebody smoking in the bathroom. We have this thing just broke, or this thing is that. And then you immediately just start like tensing up like, oh no, And then you remember, wait a minute, I'm not that captain anymore. I'm just a little piece of crap FO. You let that air out. Then you look over to the left of you, right? You look to the left, you said, boss. Because then you see the whites of his eyes. You see his face, the blood leave him. You see him start to panic. And I said, hey, I'll be over here on my phone in case you need me. Just let me know if I could do anything for you, okay? I loved it. I loved being a first officer. It was just so nice to have no responsibilities whatsoever. All you just did, you fly your little leg, you do your walk around, which I like walk arounds. I do them every other flight now. It was just fantastic, man. So it was great. It was a great ride. I mean, it's been everything that I dreamt about. It's been here, with the exception of the, you know, when it mainline now, there's a lot of, which is starting to get better, but it's starting to get better when it comes to, flight is, it's very much separated more. You know, at the regionals, it was more family feeling. At the majors, it's kind of like, all right, flight attendants have that steel door in between you. Nobody stays at the same hotels. Nobody kind of, we all switch legs. Every different legs, you're flying with somebody different, things like this. So that camaraderie with other employee groups is kind of not there yet. But I'm working on it. You know, I'm starting to finally get recognized in the terminals, not because of Pilot Daddy, just because of my charming personality, or just being nice to people. You know, I mean, gate agents start to recognize, I just finally start to be there over and over and over and over again. And so those walls come down, but it's been a great ride. But yeah, man, 737 FO, I was a happy camper.
I always used to feel guilty being like, I called myself a pumpkin. And like at SkyWest, you know, it's like pilot flying builds the box. I'd always build the box for the captain out of guilt for like how little I was responsible for as an FO. When did you decide upgrade on the 737 was for you?
Yeah, so in the CRJ world, you know, I definitely felt like I could do anything after 2 years of flying that CRJ. And now I'm at this mainliner, right? It's like totally different procedures, totally different things, totally different ways we talk, totally different ways we act, totally different. And then, of course, totally different airplane, going from a CRJ 200 to a 737, which is, you're still going back in time, you know, if you can believe that one. But so here I am, it's like, wow, this thing's doing what? This thing is what? It was constantly that for years. It's like, I don't want to upgrade on this thing until, and I'm not that your typical stereotypical pilot. Oh, yeah, I can't wait to make it that left seat and, you know, be the daddy again. You know what I mean? Or, you know, throw my weight around. I wasn't like that. I was like, I want to wait. As long as I can afford it, I want to wait until I can actually, I know what the hell that airplane's doing. You know what I mean? At all times. If something happens, if it makes a different sound. Oh. That's because the wing just fell off. I know that because I heard. So the wing just fell off and we have about 25 more seconds and then we're done. You know what I mean? I want to have that knowledge. I want to have, like, you know, the printer stops working. Like, ah, yep, you got to do this. You got to do that. Or, you know, a screen just, you know, like, oh, it's because of this, that. Or, you know, you just know more, obviously, with time. And I wanted that experience. I wanted that comfort zone of like, hey, I don't want to be caught with my pants down. What the hell's going on? You're flying with a new hire. You're flying with somebody else who's just a couple of years. Here you are on the left seat, and they're all looking at you, all of them. And now you have four flight attendants staring at you, and a first officer staring, and a gate agent, and the company itself, because so many cameras are staring at you. Like, huh? And you got about 189 people behind you staring at you. Like, oh my gosh, maybe I shouldn't have taken this upgrade earlier. I remember when I was a first officer, I would just laugh at the poor captain, and now here you are. You know, so I didn't want to be that way. So I could have upgraded in 3 years, and then so I'm like, no, I'll wait until I can hold a solid line. In about five years flying that 737, and I ain't stupid by any means, and it makes it sound like, you know, like, wait a minute, this guy just didn't have any confidence. I have confidence. I can fly a freaking jet. I can do circles. I'll make it rain up in here. You know what I mean? But I wanted that comfort zone. You know what I mean? So it's like, so 5 years in, I was like, you know what? Anything the 737 throws at me, I got you. I got you. No problem at all. So 5 years, but then boom, you know, this little thing called COVID happens. And it's like, oh boy. And then that was it. Upgrades were all done. So at that point, here I am flying with some guys and they're reaching over. And I feel I can fly better than half those guys, or I can rule the roost better than half those guys, girls, you know, and their hands are on the flaps. You want flaps yet? I'm like, did I call flaps yet? You know, it'd be starting to become that in the pocket. You know what I mean? And then you wait just a little bit longer to ask for flaps. You know, how about the gear? I'm like, no, how about nothing? You know, it would just be stuff like that. I'm like, I will tell, unless you want to fly bad enough, sir, then I will ask you when I want stuff. You know what I mean? So it started becoming like that. It was like, yeah, should have upgraded a little earlier. But
In your, so you talk about like having to make those decisions and whatnot. Have you come across any situations at United as captain where you've had to make really tough calls? Like what's the toughest call you've had to make?
Oh man, the toughest call. It's the experience, you know. You have 16,000 hours of experience, and a lot of the stuff that you had to make tough calls was back in the regional days. You know what I mean? When you're flying along, and two of your flight attendants are beating the hell out of each other, literally fist fights, and you have to make a decision. Like, well, it looks like they gotta get tossed off the airplane. You know, maybe they're probably not gonna be working for the company anymore. But as for sitting in the left seat of the 737, it's just been like, you know, there's so many pieces, like you guys know, the airlines, there's so many pieces of that freaking operation. And the way I see it is like that jet really isn't mine until they disconnect the damn headset. You know, as soon as I disconnect the headset, then I sit down, I put on my big boy pants, and that airplane's mine. But before that, it's United's. Yeah, it's United's plane. Before that, while we're boarding, it's the gate agent's planes. Because guess what? If there's an unruly passenger, there's guidelines we're supposed to go by. Like, all right, throw off the passenger if they're da 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 da. And if you're going to throw off that passenger, you're not the one to do it. You are not supposed to go back there. They want you to contact the gate agent, contact a safety person. They're the ones that's supposed to go back there and throw. You're just sitting there. So it's like, it's just... there's no big, I haven't really had to make that huge decision yet. The only thing I could think of is like, things don't really go wrong until like your very first time out of IOE, you know, the IOE, you're off your check airman, here you are. So here I am, I'm in Tampa Bay. The airplane just came out. I'm a big boy captain. It's my second trip out of IOE. You know, second trip out of IOE. I'm sitting there like, I mean, I know the plane. Like I said, I'm flying it for 7 years. I know this bad boy. I walk with a little pep in my step. You know, I'm walking like Pimp Daddy. But I'm sitting in that plane and they're like, oh yeah, the plane just came out of a C-check. Well, in your experience, in my experience, your antennas immediately go right on up. It's just, you just know. You're like, all right, I'm going to make sure I check this cockpit just really, really, really with a fine tooth comb. And guess what? We might have a problem on a taxi out, on a takeoff, on something, just because I see checks. You know, it's just sometimes things don't make it through quality control. You know what I mean? Or sometimes they miss things during quality control. So here we are. Sure enough, we push off the gate, you get a light. You get a caution light. All right, here it is. Yep, sure enough, as promised, we fix that light, no problem at all. We taxi out, we're half empty, we're light, we're going to Newark, we're taxiing out, the airplane's kind of doing its thing, we're taxiing onto the runway, it's 5 a.m. in the morning, it's nighttime still, you know, it's dark, and then we're just waking up, haven't had my eighth cup of coffee yet. And it's boom, throw those thrust levers full forward. Here we go, baby. And was the FO? I was flying. So we're going down there, you're going through 100 knots. Next thing you know, we get another light. But by the time you actually see that light flash, you're so light, you're so full of power. And it's like, by the time you see that light flash, guess what? The nose wheel is almost off the ground as it is anyway. So you see a light, it's nothing detrimental. It's not in that guide that you're supposed to reject for, right? So a light comes on. Yep, that's expected. Here we go, as we thought, right? So I just look, we got this. Yeah, we'll take it in the air. By the time I say we take it in the air, it's V1 rotate. As soon as we rotate, boom, APU fire. It's nighttime. There's freaking the whole cockpit just lights up red, you know, lights up red. You got this annoying bell screaming at you. You know, the FO is starting to convulse a little bit over there. Oh boy, here it is. And you just look over because you got to scream over the bell. You scream over the bell. You're trying to silence it, but with silence for some reason, you know. You're at 200 feet, just climbing like a bat out of hell. You just look over to you, scream to the FO, tell them we're going back. You know, that was my big decision. It wasn't a tough decision. You know what I mean? It was just like, all right, shoots hit the fan, we're on fire, we're going back. That was my big boy decision. Do I make the decision to keep going in the air and try to fight the fire and just keep flying to BFE, you know, fires you don't really want to mess with, you know what I mean? So it's like, you just fly that straight line and handle it there, try to put out the fire, try to do this, try to do that, and then you can't get a contact, everybody's supposed to contact, they're supposed to work out a plan, all that jazz. Hell no. My big boy decision was, put this beast in a crosswind, put me in a downwind, we'll put out the fire in the downwind. If it doesn't come out, guess what? We'll be on the ground in T-minus 2 minutes 32 seconds. You know what I mean? So something like that. So I'd say that was probably my big boy decision at that point.
Yeah, that's
And was it actually, did you end up blowing the bottles and everything?
Was it actually blew the bottle, fire? Absolutely. Yeah, we blew the bottle and everything, nice. Yeah. Yeah, and we landed. Yeah, the fire was out. It was gone.
Well,
yeah, it worked. Thank God, right? The engineers and all our maintenance. So big shout out to all our maintenance staff at the airline and the engineers of Boeing and everything like that. That it definitely worked out. Worked to its as described, right?
That's awesome. Yeah.
All right, so I really quickly want to shift away towards like the social media profile. So Paul told us. So we had Paul on, Paul Holte. I
yes.
You guys went through the same like leadership class together.
I envy his hairdo.
Yes. And he said that when I particularly do, if you look at my hairline, it's like the Germans out of Russia. So he said that when you got to meet Scott Kirby, that you stood up and just started like running your mouth and gave Scott Kirby like a stand-up routine.
Oh, yeah.
And so I kind of want to talk about your social, just before, you know, before we get to wrap it up here, I want to talk a bit about your social media, and I kind of want to hear that story from your perspective and just kind of how you created this pilot daddy persona, where this came from.
Yeah, so I'm an old geezer, you know what I'm saying? I'm an old man. So obviously, I probably have some life to me. So I got a few kids. So daddy, that's where daddy came from. It's not like that. I'm walking up to the jet and I'm in a Playboy robe with a corn pipe, you know, with a freaking cigar in my mouth, you know, and I'm blowing heart signs or something like that, right? So that's not happening. It's not. Yeah, not that kind of daddy, you know what I mean? So like it was daddy from that, and it was pilot. Yeah, I'm a pilot, so pilot daddy. And here you are, you know, you try to make these, you go on this social media, and I'm late to the game here on the social media. And it's like you try to come up with a name, and of course taken. Well, this is taken, that's taken, this taken. Well, pilot daddy wasn't taken. So that was that, pilot daddy. So I made a couple of videos about going to a restaurant. Here I am, I'm eating some food, and I hit the toilet 3 days later. You know, it would be just something, just like something that most people do, a day in a life, or here's that, or here's, it's just so boring. You know what I mean? It just wasn't entertaining whatsoever. So I'm like, I ain't, and it didn't take off. It didn't hit. My little restaurant reviews with a little quirkiness didn't hit. So I'm like, all right, I'm done with this crap, right? But then I was like, well, no, you know what? Pilots are so stereotypical. Flight attendants are so stereotypical. You know, you see these pilots on there. I mean, we discussed this about our SkyWest ERJ flyers there. It's like, and it's so boring. And I just laugh and you shake your head and you're like, you know what, you little sons of guns. I said, your ass is mine. So and I just started making fun of everybody. I just make fun of the stupid stuff that we do as pilots and flight attendants. You know what I mean? And so... And it's like, and it's real. The thing of it is, the stuff that you see on my social media, pilotdaddy_US or Jet Clipper on the TikTok there, that is the day in the life of a pilot. It's like everything you see there, it really is, the whole thing is day in a life of a pilot. It's not that glorious thing like where you see, and I'll shout out Paul, Mr. Layover Man there. I forget his call sign there on Layover Life or My Layover. But I mean, he has the drone. He's got it over there. Here I am, and he's swimming he's swimming out there with his banana hammock. And he's like, "Yes, I'm swimming in the Alps back here doing the breaststroke, you know." And just glorious thing, this picturesque sunset. And he's got that monotone voice. Here I am now. I'm walking out the door, and I just opened the door, but the doorknob was a little slimy, so I had to wipe my hand on my jeans as I go out. For a little dinner. And it's just like that. It's like, really? And everybody's trying to do that same damn thing. It's like, that's not the life. That is not the pilot life. I'm sorry. It's not. There's so much more. And it's like, whenever you see like TV shows, right? So Pan Am, which I do a lot of Pan Am stuff. So Pan Am, it was a TV show at one point, right? They only made it through one season. Why? Because it wasn't real. You and I both, you guys know that we can literally, and we always say this all the time, is we can make a TV show about this stuff. We can write a book. We can do this stuff if we were real, you know what I mean? But the shows you see on TV, it's just not real enough. Yeah, here they are. The very opening thing about the Pan Am, like, I'm all excited, Mr. Pan Am. Like, ooh, yeah, let's watch this Pan Am stuff, right? Here we go. Well, it's the captain is in a freaking convertible, and he's got a smile from ear to ear. His makeup was done right. He's driving down Fifth Avenue. You see the Pan Am building in the back. He meets his first officer and this absolutely gorgeous flight attendants. And then they get in the airplane. It's like, all right, Captain. And the first officer, all right, Captain, are you ready? And he's like, yes, I'm ready. And then they get in there, and the sun's setting, the sun's rising. They throw in the thrust levers and full forward there, and the roar of the the 7074 and is going. And what are they doing? What do? We stare forward. What do those two boys do? They turn around and look at each other. And they smile like they're about to, like they're going to, I'm not going to go there. But they smile as they're roaring down a runway at 100 knots. You know, they're just looking at each other, the big smile. It is like, what? And then sure enough, the show doesn't make it. It doesn't make it. They get canceled. Why? Because it was stupid. It was boring. Because it wasn't real. So the stuff you said, like, Pilot Daddy, when are you going to do a day in the life? I'm like, my stuff is day in the life. You watch every single one of my things. It is real. It is the real stuff that happens. Yeah, I embellish a little bit, or I laugh at myself and I make fun of, but it's the real stuff. So anyway, so here I was, you know, yeah, I'm over here. I'm eating dinner and I just, I pooped my pants as I went back to the layover. It wasn't hitting, right? It wasn't hitting. So then I'm like, all right, I'm going to do some phone calls. I'm going to do some phone calls, like these flight attendants calling up the cabin, you know. And the song, what I picked the song was, I know it's crazy, but here's my number, so call me baby. It's like whatever that song, some chick sings it or whatever the heck. But so I pretended that here I am. I'm sitting in the cockpit, right? And I'm sitting in there, flight deck, right? And I got the phone, and here that the song's playing there. And I'm pretending that, oh, they're asking us to heat the cabin. And then the next phone call is cold the cabin, heat the cabin, cold the cabin, heat the cabin, cold the cabin, heat the cabin. Boom. It goes viral. It takes off. I'm like, oh, so people like what I think in my head, right? People like that, right? And the next one, then I come out with the next one. I'm in Houston, right? And I'm like, I pretend I got a water bottle ahead of me, in front of me, right? I'm pretending that a 747 taxis by, right? So I'm just talking with the boys, you know, we're chit-chatting, having a good time, you know, 747 taxis with the boys, and I got a water bottle ahead of in front of me that's insinuating that it's a something else, right? So the 747 tax by that, as you just see my face, I'm talking, then you're just stunned, like most pilots do, right? You see something big like that taxi by, you're gonna watch it, right? You're gonna watch, your eyes are big and open, here you are, you're turning your head. Well, then the music playing in the background just hits to a point, and then of course I squeeze the water bottle, flashes there too, and then that took off. And then Pilot Daddy, the meaning of daddy took a whole nother persona, and the stuff I was getting in my messages and the stuff I was getting in the as this whole daddy thing, I was like, oh God, this is not what I wanted it to be. But the account was taken off, and again, like I said, I'm just showing the real life of a pilot. And here you are. And then other guy, you have your haters out there too, like, this is embarrassing. What? This is exactly what happens to us. Are you kidding me? I mean, you think you're so cool. You think you walk out of that cop and these girls are like, oh man, pilot, sign my autograph, or take a Sharpie and sign my left butt cheek. No, it's not like that. It's like, people don't care. We are nobodies. We are merely a figure that's just to get us people from point A to point B. And half the time, people don't even say, the pilots don't even say goodbye to passengers. It's just like, it's just gone. You know what I mean? So, and these pilots think they're somebody, like our ERJ's 175 pilots, right? We think that people are looking outside the window of the terminal like, wow, there's Pilot Tom with his Ray-Ban sunshades, and look, he's taking the turban, and look, he's putting his hand in it and spinning it. That must be what they do to make sure that airplane flies. Get the hell out of here. So yeah, so all I do is just make fun of that stuff and just poke fun at all the things. And it really is comical, the stuff that we do. I mean, my last TikTok I just did was we have a horn. We have a ground call button, right? That's the last one I did. It's a ground call button. And you push it to alert, hey, we're done with it. And not to annoy your ground crew, because God bless them, we love our ground crew. Much respect, mad respect. I buy them coffees all the time. But so they look up at you, like, hey, you ready to disconnect? Ready to disconnect? But your APU isn't started. So you start the APU. They disappear to go do some more work. Once the APU is going, you go ahead and flick that little horn there, ground call, and they come up. Oh, yeah, you ready to disconnect? Sure. Well, I'm going to go ahead and show the good people of TikTok, hey, did you know this? I mean, it's a learning thing too, right? Because you have those other pilots like, yeah, this flight deck, we have the controls, and the controls, if you bank it to the right, you turn right. If you bank it to the left, you turn left. And here I am, Pilot Tim, here on TikTok. Have a nice day. Well, my education is going to be like, hey, we have a horn, much like your car. And then we also have a window to where you scream out stuff. So I push the horn like this is how we fly in Jersey and New York. So I push the horn. I open the window. I'm like, hey, we're flying here. You know what I mean? But it so it shows. Yeah, it's embellished a little bit and it shows a little personality. But on the other hand, we do that. We hit the horn. And if they can't understand you, you open the window like, hey, I need that fuel slip. You know, you really are. We do that. That is a day in our that is a real day in our life. We spill coffee on each other. There's freaking sunflower seeds for some God knows reason on the floor. Somebody leaves their spit cup in the cockpit. Yeah, we're not that sophisticated. We're not that cool. That's the pilot daddy account, you know, so that's where it's at.
Did you know the CRJ has a horn?
Oh, this is a you trying to trick question me? Let me think.
It does. It's in the back. It's an APU horn.
Yeah. So when you flick the button, right, you got to hold that button up.
Yeah.
And you let go, right? Yeah, that's right. I remember that. Yeah. Uh-huh.
I just think I love the account because, like, I think there's something about maybe that, like, upper peninsula flying that we did at SkyWest that, like, really grounds you and makes you aware of, like, your place in the aviation world, right? When you're doing flow-through flights, jumping your way across upper peninsula Michigan, you kind of realize, like, wow, I am a true regional pilot. And so I've always loved the account because I just can't stand watching these people. They're like, come with me on a day to work and I'm going to Myrtle. This is a Myrtle Beach turn out of Newark. And then I'm going to overnight in Charleston. And they all have that same up talk, you know, the upspeak where it's like, and here's the hotel. And I went into the gym and I had one of my pre-made dinners and I went to bed at 9 o'clock. And that's nothing and what I used to do. I used to go down to the lobby. I'd buy a pack of M&Ms. I'd pour the M&Ms out in the bed with me, laying in bed with my M&Ms, watching like Wife Swap, you know, or whatever was on at that hour, right? And you're just kind of eating the M&M and you find one later that you've been laying on without knowing, right? And that's life as a pilot. It's not the glamour that these people post on social media.
Absolutely.
I don't know if Matt ever did something as horrible as that is laying in bed with his with the M&Ms he bought, but like I mean I don't know.
Laying in bed eating M&Ms, watching Wife Swap was not my night of choice at the hotel. But no, it's definitely not. You know, it's funny to see the videos because it's so true. You know, there's so many times where you pop the window open and start screaming at somebody. It's like, you know, and especially if you scream a little too loud and a passenger's boarding, you know, they look up at you and you're like, I'm just trying to get the
is he okay? And they still walk in the back. Yeah. I'm like, if you really had the balls to ask if your pilot's okay, but yet you still keep walking in the back, like, were you really concerned? I hope if he's something else, he'd be walking outside, but.
I like to give Matt a hard time.
I do have a question.
Oh.
No, go ahead.
I like to give Matt a hard time because Matt likes to stand after his good landings. Like, Matt actually gets up there and presents himself to the cabin. I can't wait to get to the Brugger's Bagels. Like, I don't care how the landing was. I'm running to Brugger's. Matt stands there. Matt once told me he stood there for all 186 people getting off. And I just have to commend the size of the ego required to want that admiration.
Somebody like that, you know, I grew, you know, you grow up in the Pan Am day with a pilot did say goodbye to passions, but it's like good smash landing or a good landing. I'm always back there. And if it is a bad landing, cause guess what? Believe me, pilot daddy smashes it on the ground. Sometimes I don't say that in any of my videos by any means, but it happens. But I'll smash it on the ground or, you know, and then I'll get back there. Then I'll get on the PA. I'm like, hey, you win some, you lose some. Send me your chiropractic bill. You know what I mean? Maybe it just loosens up people back there some more. But it's like, yeah, shit happens, you know. But we're on the ground. And I still think about it. And people bust your chops, but it just gives me a good laugh. You know what I mean? Or like you said, if you only have about 30 minutes, then it's over to Brugger's Bagels and you can go get your freaking chipotle pepper egg on a white bagel, sesame bagel.
Oh, yeah.
I once had a line chicken to make me stand. Because I just destroyed, the CRJ into Fargo one afternoon, and the flight attendant opens the door and she's crying, laughing. She's like, "Who did that?" And all the first class passengers are crying, laughing because she started crying, laughing, and the captain's like, yeah, you better go stand for that one. I'm going to go make sure the tail's still on. So he took the walk around so that I could have to stand there and get the comments from every single person who got off the plane. It was horrible, horrible moment in my, like, one of the more humbling moments in my aviation career. God.
And it's like, those passengers back there, they're just real freaking people. They're real people. And I like,
and they're laughing. Like, they're laughing at you as they get off because they know why you're standing there.
They see you giggling a little bit. Now, like, hey, these people are like us, you know what I mean? Yeah, these people, this is their 9-to-5 job. They're doing too, you know, just to pay the bills, you know? So it brings them to they think we're up here. They think that we think that we're up here, but it's not. It's more like down here. But it's like, we're on everybody's level. We're just all humans. We all have a story to tell, you know? We all have lives. We all have our issues, you know? It's like, we're all in this game together, you know what I mean?
Matt, you had a question, and then I guess we can jump into trivia.
Yeah. Oh, a quick question. Where did the love and obsession with Pan Am come from?
See, I've always been a big, you know, when it comes to history of aviation and the airlines. See, I'm not anything like F-16s, military, or this cool air, SR-71, all that kind of airplane. I've always been airliners. You know what I mean? It's always.
Oh.
I think we lost his audio.
Yeah, never mind.
Yeah, we're here now.
You're good there? Yeah, so I had, I saw the dream was always been 747, loaded full of 400 people. You know, you have absolutely gorgeous flight attendants back there. Yeah, you say it was making $400,000 a year, flying only 3 days a month. You know, that was the dream, you know, forever, you know. And then as I'm growing up, you know, you see, I was only 11 when Pan Am actually went out. But just reading on the story, you know, just, As we are all growing up in this industry, you see half these pilots aren't wearing hats. You see half these pilots, you know, they have backpacks on. Not that's anything wrong if you want a backpack, but you have half these pilots, they got their headphones on that aren't earbuds anymore. Like, yeah. So I ordered a pizza, then I bought this prostitute down in Bogota. You know, and they're screaming outside. It's like, That's not the guys. I thought these guys were gods. You know what I mean? That's not the people that I learned to respect. These are losers. You know what I mean? So it's like, back in the Pan Am days, those were sophisticated pilots. You know, those guys were, you know, were like, whoa, those guys, you know, that was it. They made it the day, you know, Pan Am, the way our uniforms looked, the way they were, it was done by Pan Am. It was the Juan Trip wanted them to emulate the Navy pilots or the Navy ship, you know, the Navy ship drivers, you know, a Navy ship, what do they call those? Navy boaters? I don't know. But and why they called their airplanes clipper ships? Because they're floating boats. You know, they're floating boats in the sky. So just the amount of history and the stuff that we use today was all started from them. And if you just dive deep into the Pan Am story, it's like it's really just a. It's almost like the Titanic. You know, it's a Titanic was just this glitz glamour. You know, Pan Am was this glitz glamour. Pan Am was our nation's, was pretty much our nation's flag carrier. You know what I mean? It was our flag right. carrier. They were the only ones who allowed to do these international destinations. And they started it all. They built these airports in the middle of BFE. You know, they built these airports. They flew into them. They crashed so many times and lives have lost to make it for us to fly easy into later, you know, so they started all this stuff. So, and then much like the Titanic, the glitz and glamour, then all of a sudden it just freaking hits the iceberg. And this poor airline, it just hit multiple icebergs and you just know the story's going to go down. But just reading more and more and more and just the stuff that I still learn to this day is just like, wow. So yeah, so that was the Pan Am persona. And as we all get older, you know, especially the new generations coming up, nobody knows Pan Am. You know, Pan Am what? Pan Am this, Pan Am that. I always hope Pan Am would come back. You know, they would name their ships. Every ship was Clipper something, Clipper something, Clipper something. And did you know David Nealon, before he started the JetBlue, he was going to have JetBlue be the reincarnation of Pan Am. He was going to name his airline Pan Am, but they end up just going for JetBlue instead. But he said, I will name every single one of my airplanes like Pan Am did. So, you know, you see blue for you or blue, or, you know, I found blue juice in my toilet. You know, it's just like stuff like that you see on their airplane, but that's all Pan Am right there. So that's the whole persona. So I the history buff, the books, that kind of stuff. I like all the old Pan Am gear, the Pan Am freaking, yeah. If you look, I have one room that's strictly the Skyloft, I call it. It's all nothing but Pan Am. So here we are now with this account. And I had nothing but my airline paraphernalia. I had the lanyard that said United. I had all this United stuff. But then when they had some haters out there, I'm like, wait, am I doing something wrong? Am I doing, I don't want to get anywhere near a line that could, well, get myself in trouble. You know what I mean? Not there's anything that I do that puts myself in trouble. But so I was like, you know what? Just to not even dance around that line, just in case I do want to get a little risque, but yet still keep that Pan Am name going. You know what? I'm adopting Pan Am. And that was it. It's the rest is history. It's like, it's all Pan Am now. And people actually think this, and the airline still exists. Like, I was just talking to somebody on a message. They're like, so I've never heard Pan Am coming down here. I'm like, yeah, because they've been out of business since 91. Like, wait, you work for somebody else? Well, yeah, you're like, yeah, Pan Am. Yeah, Pan Am. There's no Pan Am. Gosh, and people really believe that. Yeah, sure. I'm like, but I like that. I think it's cool. So we're going with Pan Am, baby.
Nice. Yeah. Yeah, that's really cool. It's I know Pan. A lot of people in the industry really like Pan Am. I mean, they've done a lot.
Oh,
of
yeah.
And stuff. There's the board game.
Some of those older airlines.
Yeah, it's a board game, but it's hard as hell too. I
have it.
I just got it just says Pan Am. So,
yeah. Should we jump into some trivia?
Let's jump into so Rob. We end every podcast with trivia.
Making me feel stupid. And is that what it is?
I mean, most people kind of get through. And we'll there's like a happens. Nominal Starbucks gift card.
It's like a game. That's
the only thing is you reject you Starbucks gift cards.
Gift card.
What?
Right. Well, I'll give the if I win, I'll give those gift cards away to somebody else. Make their day.
Well, we can substitute right. Duncan in is the point. We can substitute some Duncan in. Okay.
All right. Well, it sounds good. We got T-minus 14. I need to leave you guys anyway.
Perfect. We've got seven.
Sounds
we've
good.
Got
we'll seven finish this questions. Up here quick.
All right, Matt, you can go first.
All right. What building is United Airlines headquartered up?
Yeah, the Willis Tower.
There you go. Money.
I was there two One weeks down. Ago. It was great. Gorgeous building. Go ahead.
Who's considered the founder of United Airlines?
Oh, Boeing. It was like a Boeing company.
Yeah, so it's like, William Boeing.
Yeah. Oh, William Boeing. Oh, there you have it. Boeing. Great. Sweet.
All right. In 1928 and 29, William Boeing acquired Pacific Air Transport, Pratt & Whitney, and formed what airline?
Beats me.
United Aircraft and Transportation
Corporation. Yeah, see, I wasn't even going to try.
One sec, I got it. All right. Which plane did United introduce which enabled nonstop transcontinental flight to passengers?
Transcontinental flight. Let's guess. What airplane can make it that far? It's got to be a Boeing something, right? So, Boeing yeah, it was something. A Boeing something. Well, 314 was the. Yeah, there you go. That's the guess. 314.
It was the 247.
Oh man, I knew it was some numbers.
In what year did United merge with Continental?
Oh, is that 11? Was it 2011?
Drew has a 2010 as the answer. He's been known to be wrong before.
All right, 2010.
What famous musical piece plays in the background of the safety video?
That's Rhapsody in Blue.
There you go.
Nice. All right. Yeah. All right. Number seven. How many aircraft are in the United Airlines fleet, roughly?
Last I checked was 958 mainline jets.
Ooh, then I'm way wrong.
That could be right. Drew, we got 866 down.
No,
could be.
Oh, we're growing.
That's what a basic Google search returned in my.
Well, yeah, and aren't you guys adding like two aircraft a week or something or a month? Nuts.
It's great. Yeah, it's fantastic. So yeah, they're
for the next like 10 years.
Yep.
Is it a pretty even awesome. Split of Max and Airbus?
No. So the Airbuses start coming in later, but we got about 500 Maxes coming. Yeah, 500 Maxes coming. And it's only like 100 Airbuses. Yeah.
Nice. Well, cool. Got anything else,
pilot? Man, shoot. No, thanks for having me on. You know, I mean, it was a pleasure.
I appreciate
you all sending me your gifts, you know, so I got your bottle of water and your can of pumpkin puree. Appreciate that. Y'all are kind.
Thank you. This was another episode of Living in Flight. If you liked this episode, please make sure to subscribe for more exclusive aviation content. Have any topic ideas or want to be featured on our podcast? Send us a message at listen@livinginflight.com. Thank you for joining us. And until next time, this is Living in Flight.